Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
All in favor say aye. All opposed say nay. The ayes have it. The bill is in the Senate. The assembly is adjourned.
And so the Wisconsin bill to limit collective bargaining for public employees passed the state assembly a little after 1 o'clock this morning. The standoff continues in their state Senate. So how does this affect you? Let's say you are Terry taxpayer. You are Perry private sector. You see the pensions and health care benefits and seniority rights that public sector workers get that are unavailable to you in the private sector, and you think, that's not fair. That's my tax money. Too expensive, unsustainable, and out of sync with the times. You see public sector employees having a union at all when you don't have one anymore. But you also think, do I want to help the downward benefit spiral for all workers? Will this come back and even worse pay and benefits and job security for me down the road? And there is the dilemma for many Americans in the private sector as they take sides in Wisconsin or figure out how to, and over this issue of trying to end collective bargaining for public employees and switch to 401ks and require more health insurance payments. Fundamentally, are the interests of government workers more aligned with private sector workers, or are they more opposed? Are public sector unions the moral equivalent of private sector unions or not? Is the Wisconsin showdown part of a larger corporate movement to bust all unions and grab more money away from all workers? Or is it a unique situation created by the unique political nature of government economics where the unions help elect the bosses they negotiate supposedly against? Let's get two views. Dean Baker, co-director of the liberal think tank, the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and E.J. McMahon, senior fellow for tax and budgetary studies at the conservative Manhattan Institute think tank and director of their Empire Center for New York State Policy. Dean and E.J., welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning.
And listeners, you get in on this too. Are public sector unions and private sector unions the moral equivalents? And even more to the point, is what happens to people in a public sector union an indication of what will happen to you if you're in the private sector? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post your comments to our politics website, itsafreecountry.org. Dean Baker, Time magazine columnist Joe Klein, liberal on most things, wrote this week, industrial unions are organized against the might and greed of ownership. Public employee unions are organized against the might and greed of the public, he asked. So can you start there and answer Joe Klein's question? Who are public unions organized against, if not us, the private sector taxpayers?
Well, as usual, Joe Klein asked the wrong question. We've had a remarkable piece of jujitsu here. We're sitting here in the worst downturn since the Great Depression because of an incredible run of Wall Street greed. We have these Wall Street guys are back up on their feet, making incredible profits, paying themselves huge bonuses. Bill Daley, President Obama's chief of staff, got a $9 million going away present from J.P. Morgan. And instead of being bad at Wall Street, we've got people angry at school teachers and firefighters. We have the data on this. The compensation of public sector employees is actually somewhat less than private sector workers. So what public sector unions are about is getting workers their share, about ensuring them some security in their job. I think they've done a good thing for their workers, but the idea that somehow that their wages and benefits are out of line with the private sector, that doesn't correspond to reality.
Well, there are probably some stats, and I don't want to get bogged down in dueling stats where they are, some stats where there aren't, but in your opinion, is the fate of private sector workers at stake with what happens to the public sector workers, or is it separate?
Well, it's part of an ongoing drift. We used to have 20% unionization rates in the private sector as recently as 1980, and by conscious policy of the Reagan administration, I would say its successors as well, we've had policies that have beaten down unionization among private sector workers, so it is under 7% now, so it's now a rarity that private sector workers have a pension. Many fewer have even health care coverage at their workplace. So we've seen a weakening of the bargaining position of private sector workers, and now there's this effort to do the same to public sector workers. So I'd say it's part of a process. It's not as though If you see the public sector unions beaten back, suddenly everyone in the private sector is going to take a really big hit. But it is part of this process of weakening the position of workers generally.
E.J. McMahon, same questions. Are public sector unions the moral equivalent of private sector unions? And is the fate of private sector workers at stake with what happens to public sector workers?
Well, I would answer no to both questions. I think that there never actually has been that much of a similarity other than the name between private sector unions and public sector unions. Government's a monopoly, and public sector unions essentially are a set of cartels negotiating with a monopoly under rules in many states that are favorable to their interests. You posed the question, is this an indication of what will happen to you, Mr. or Mrs. Taxpayer?
Mm-hmm.
I would say, you should be so lucky, because for instance, what's being proposed in Wisconsin is not a reduction or a tearing down of or a downward spiral in their benefits or pensions. For instance, one of the items on that governor's so-called budget repair agenda is a provision that would require Wisconsin's public employees to contribute more to their pensions, not to eviscerate the pension benefit, but to have them contribute more to the pension benefit because the cost is rising and the taxpayers can't afford it.
How would public sector workers, in your opinion, EJ, without collective bargaining, get a fair shake in the future in the wages and benefits and working conditions? If the teachers union, for example, can't collectively bargain class size or how they're evaluated, how can they have a reasonable say?
Well, that's the case in almost half the country now. And in fact, it's the case in the federal government. If Walker's entire proposal in Wisconsin prevails, Wisconsin state workers will still have slightly more in the way of collective bargaining privileges than federal government workers received from President Kennedy in 1962. That was the event that many historians thought faithfully hastened the trend to public sector unionization. But in fact, on the federal level, to this day, federal employees work in what's known as an open shop. They're not compelled to pay union dues or join a union. They bargain workplace issues and personnel policies, but they don't bargain wages and benefits. And again, not to get into the dueling statistics, but by many measures that I think are trustworthy, federal employees do quite well.
So, Dean, what about EJ's point that if private sector workers had exactly what Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, is asking for in terms of wages and benefits, they'd be doing a lot better than they are doing now. So how bad can you feel for the workers in Wisconsin?
Well, I'm afraid we do have to look at the data here, and there is data on this. And in fact, public sector employees, their total compensation, what they get by wages, pension, health care, everything you throw into the mix, is somewhat less than private sector workers as it stands now. If we do, as Governor Scott proposes, have them pay more from their wages for their pensions, for their health care, then we're reducing their compensation further below their private sector counterparts. So we could do that, and, in the short term, if you have a teacher that's, 55 or something, that's right. He or she's probably stuck there. They're not going to see an alternative there. They're tied to their job. But I think it's unfair to those people, and what's more, over the long term, you're going to get fewer people, or we might say people with fewer skills applying for those jobs. As it stands now, you don't see the top students at Harvard rushing to become teachers in the public sector. They might rush to go to Wall Street. A lot of them do that. They aren't lining up for those jobs. If we cut the pay and benefits 10-20%, yeah, we could do that. We'll still find bodies, but that's not going to be a good public sector.
All right, listeners, is the fate of private sector workers at stake with what happens to the public sector workers in Wisconsin and elsewhere? Brian in Ramsey, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
I listen to you guys a lot. And, yeah, I definitely think this is, it's an assault on workers, average middle-class workers. But, again, I think what these angry people who have low-paying jobs, I think somebody had said earlier, they're angry at people that do have benefits, and they're asking, hey, why do they have it? And we don't. What these people should be asking is, why don't we have these benefits? Why does my CEO make $220 million a year, and I don't have any decent benefits? That's the question that should be asked.
Thank you. So, EJ, to that point, how do you see the nature of the issue in Wisconsin and elsewhere along these lines. Is it an attempt to highlight these public versus private sector union differences, or just an attack on all unions, as the union side claims?
No, I really do think that this is focused on public sector unions, and in particular, it's resulted from the impact of the recession and the financial crisis and what it did to state and local budgets. The problem with the public sector labor setup in many of these states, in about half the states, is that the business model of public sector unions is not flexible. They're intensely political organizations in themselves. And when management comes to a labor union in a state that has very strong a strong array of collective bargaining privileges, like Wisconsin or New York and many other sort of northern tier states, and says, you know, our revenues have just plunged into a hole. We can't even see the bottom yet. We're running out of money. We've got enormous deficit. Can we make some changes to the salaries and benefits here? Because if not, we're going to have to lay off a lot of workers and cut services and raise taxes a lot, and we don't want to do that. The unions generally are inflexible when faced with those types of requests. The norm tends to be a great deal of resistance to anything in the way of real concessions. Perhaps some modest temporary concession in exchange for a contract extension. But at the end of the day, and Walker pointed this out in his speech in Wisconsin a few days ago when he was a local official, when you go to unions and say, look, we need concessions because the bottom's dropped out of our revenue and we can't afford the deal we made with you, the unions say, and you say, if I don't do it, I have to lay off a lot of people, unions generally say, go ahead and lay them off. And that has been the case. That was the case here in New York in repeated cycles. And I'm afraid it's going to be the case again on the state level where the governor's seeking concessions and threatening layoffs now.
So Dean Baker, David Brooks wrote in his New York Times column this week, public sector unions and private sector unions are very different creatures. Private sector unions push against the interests of shareholders and management. Public sector unions push against the interests of taxpayers, same as Joe Klein wrote. Then he goes on, private sector union members know that their employers could go out of business, so they have an incentive to mitigate their demands. Public sector union members work for state monopolies and have no such interest. Private sector unions confront managers who have an incentive to push back against their demands. Public sector unions face managers who have an incentive to give in to them for the sake of their own survival. And he concludes, most important, public sector unions help choose those they negotiate with. Through gigantic campaign contributions and overall clout, they have enormous influence over who gets elected to bargain with them, especially in state and local races. So do all those differences matter to you?
Well, I think David Brooks must have been out of the country for most of the last four decades. Look, this is overly simplistic. Public sector unions do not enjoy monopolies. I know a lot of people. In fact, I went to private school for part of my education. You don't have a monopoly there. You have charter schools in most states. Most public services often compete with private sector services. So this idea of a monopoly is absurd. And flip it over to the private side, you have oligopolies like General Motors, which for a long, long time you could argue the managers made excessive concessions to unions. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that. You'd have to look at them more carefully. But, you know, this idea, this contrast that David Brooks is drawing between the private sector as everything's highly competitive and, you know, you're going against the boss as opposed to being passed on in higher prices, which most people would say, most economists would say typically happens. This is just a nonsense division. What you have is unions represent workers, and there are upsides and downsides to that. To some extent, when workers get higher benefits, yes, that's going to mean more taxpayer dollars. It's going to mean higher prices for products. That's, you know, to some extent going to be true. The flip side of that is ideally there'll be a happier, more productive workforce. There's a lot of evidence to support that. You'll have less turnover. So there's advantages to that as well. So, and, you know, and I'll just add one more thing. One aspect about being in a union is you can't be fired on the spot with no recourse. And that's something that I think workers, you know, both public and private sector value enormously.
Dean Baker, co-director of the liberal think tank, the Center for Economic and Policy Research, with E.J. McMahon, senior fellow for tax and budgetary studies at the conservative think tank, the Manhattan Institute, and director of their Empire Center for New York State Policy. As we talk about the implications for the private sector of what's going on with public sector unions in Wisconsin and elsewhere. And Alex in Jamaica, you're on WNYC. Hello, Alex.
Hello, Brian. My point is that people, you know, on the left side of this are saying unions are very important, unions are so key. do they then support the unionization of the military and the armed forces? I can tell you from experience that the armed forces' pay for a new private is amazingly low. No one would say that their job's not important, and they have nobody, you know, saying let's unionize them. Why is that? And, you know, should it happen? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dean, I guess that's for you.
Well, there are places where you do have unionization in the military. I believe Denmark, I may have the country wrong, Denmark or I think Holland, one or the other. You could, in principle, have that. It's not impossible. You have to try and reconcile that with military control. I mean, there are major differences between the military and the civilian workforce. Most obviously, you can't just quit the military. So I wouldn't say it's impossible. You do have sectors. Of course, police are unionized. The FBI is unionized, or chunks of it are. So it's not inconsistent with having, you know, some sort of security military-type functions. So, you know, I wouldn't say it's impossible, but you would have to design the framework such that you wouldn't have a situation where a commanding officer tells their troops to go into battle and they say, okay, we're on strike.
Right.
You have to make sure that's not going to be an issue.
EJ, in Indiana, Governor Mitch Daniels, considered a Republican presidential hopeful, singles out public unions, when he speaks about this. Here's one clip.
The most powerful special interests in America today are the government unions.
But the bill in Indiana in the legislature would also weaken private sector unions, allowing workers to stop joining and stop paying dues to unions that bargain on their behalf. And we know that the Koch brothers helping to fund Scott Walker also help fund groups like the Competitive Enterprise Institute that works to weaken private sector unions. So does all that lend credence to the argument that this is part of a broader corporate attack on all unions?
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll set up a George Soros dial for you and a David Koch dial for me, and then we'll pretend they're fighting. I mean, put aside that kind of stuff. What happened in Indiana did not have a collective bargaining mandate for public employees until it was imposed by executive order by Daniels' predecessor. Daniels repealed that executive order when he took office several years ago. So collective bargaining for public employees is not actually an issue in Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
In Indiana, the Republicans in the legislature were mounting an attempt to make Indiana a right-to-work state, which nearly half the states are, I believe, which means a state that has an open shop. Actually, Daniels did not cooperate in that effort. While he did not oppose it, he did not make it possible. And in fact, I think that effort has pretty much died there, because he sees his focus there as being other issues that are higher priority. So that's a different kind of situation there. I did want to address one thing that frequently comes up. I think defenders of the public sector unions often kind of create this straw man where if any aspect of the program in Wisconsin is enacted, they imply, you know, we're on our way to just a sweatshop situation in government where employees have no rights at all against unfair dismissal, et cetera. But let me give you an example from New York, which is typical of most states. Before any public sector unions existed, the state civil service law had a salary grading system, including annual pay increments. That was introduced in the late 1930s. By 1941, civil service employees here had the right to a hearing if faced with disciplinary charges. Pensions were established starting over a century ago. And in 1955, all the competitive class employees in civil service in New York were given tenure, not just teachers, all of them. So before public sector unions got their feet on the ground and were granted sanctioned privileges to collectively bargain, their members or their would-be members already enjoyed an array of rights and privileges that in the private sector people formed unions to get. So that's one big difference here between the two sectors that I think is frequently overlooked.
Dean, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, a couple points. I mean, it's true. In many states, workers have been able to get rights whether or not they were in a union, and that's great, I think. I mean, I wish all workers had some protection against sort of unjust dismissal. That would be a good thing, you know, that your employer had to show that you weren't doing your job, and most countries have some protection like that. Many public sector workers have that, even if they're not in a union. Very few private sector workers who are not in a union have that protection. Getting to this other point, though, I think it's important to understand what supposedly is right to work, what's at issue there. If a union represents a bargaining unit, they are legally required to represent everyone in that unit. That doesn't mean just that everyone gets the same wage and benefit package. It means that if you have someone who doesn't like the union, they end up, the boss wants to fire them or discipline them over something, The union is obligated, legally obligated, to represent that person. So what's at issue here is, could the union say, well, we want everyone that we represent to have to pay for that representation? And the rules that Governor Walker is trying to put in place, and many other Republican governors around the country, are saying, no, someone could get union representation without paying for it. That's what we're arguing about here.
So is that in the Wisconsin bill?
The right to work provision, yes.
There's a provision to strip the unions of their dues checkoff, I believe. I don't think that Wisconsin's not a right to work state, and I'm not sure.
No, he wants to make it a right to work state, though. For the public sector workers, he wants to take away the checkoff, and also he wants to prohibit. He wants it to be an open shop. Workers do not have to pay dues.
What I understood was that he wants annual elections by unions to recertify them as the representatives of their members, and he wants to end the dues checkoff. And as we've seen,
in the private sector?
No, in the public sector only.
Okay.
I don't think that's quite the same thing.
He wants them not to be required to pay dues for their representation. That's very clear. That's why that's part of the story of not having the checkoff. The implication is you don't have to pay dues, otherwise it would make no sense.
Right. Well, EJ, if they're negotiating on all the workers' behalf and all the workers get the pay and benefits that they negotiate for, then why shouldn't they be required to pay in?
Well, the other side of that, and this is a 50-year-old argument on between right to work and closed shop people in different states, and about half the country is right to work. The other side of that argument is, why should I be compelled to pay money to anybody who I don't agree with and to a group I don't want to belong to? I think that it's fair to say, and I've met and talked to many people in unions of different political stripes who have frankly said and admitted they don't actually agree with what the union always does. Unions, for instance, as I said, and this is a standard approach, when a governor or a mayor says, I've got a budget crunch, I need concessions, or I'm going to have to do mass layoffs, the union's official position almost invariably is, you know, go ahead and lay off if you want to. We'll oppose it, and we're not making concessions. Even though there's often members of the union who say, you know, I'll make a concession. I'd rather save jobs. I talked to quite a few state employees here in Albany who took that position while their unions were successfully resisting concessions the last few years.
Well,
they have no choice but to be part of that.
We're certainly not going to solve it all here today, but there's part of the discussion about public employee workers and private sector workers. Dean Baker from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, E.J. McMahon from the Manhattan Institute and their Empire Center for New York State Policy. Thank you both so much.
Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, how about those commutes that do not involve Manhattan? A new survey finds the worst commutes in New York City are between boroughs other than Manhattan. We will take your stories of commuting really anywhere in our region that does not involve Manhattan and suggestions for improvement. Stay with us.